from Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 137 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winson, and today I'm going to be taking a look at a show that, well, I watched and took notes for several months ago and never got around to actually doing the show. It was at the beginning of my unemployment, and now that that's all over, I can finally get around to, upon request, which I'll get to in a second, NWA Power Hour from January 26, 1990, kind of a mildly famous show because of the crowd in Johnson City, Tennessee that night just being absolutely insane, out of their minds, and it, in fact, would change the course of wrestling history, which I'll get into in a little bit. But first, my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter, @GFAllentownPod. That is @GFAllentownPod. And if you follow me there, I do like to annotate stuff from this show. Like last week, I posted, you know, pictures of the bears fighting each other in Alaska that I think I referred to during the show, and also, you know, various clips such as the Iron Sheik's infamous boner going down on Hulk Hogan. Okay, maybe that's not the best choice of terminology for that, but the damn, I've said enough about the Iron Sheik's boner. And you may be listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, and on Pro Wrestling Only, of course, you have released yesterday WorldCast with Kelly, Pete, and Johnny looking at World Class Championship Wrestling from 1983. It's so shocking how much, you know, you get a little bit sick of the Von Erichs and the Freebirds at a certain point, and you're like, ooh, Jimmy Garvin and Chris Adams. Like, that is the feud where it's at in late 1983 World Class. I know I said it before, but I need to go back to watching World Class on the network from late 83, because I enjoy watching it along with that show. And you can also watch WCW Thunder with the Days of Thunder podcast, which is now in spring of 1998. So near the beginning of Thunder's run. And you can catch up fairly easily because it's still pretty tolerable at that point. But I would be remiss if I did not mention the new show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, Boom Goes the Dynamite. I'm hoping that this will be fairly regular with Jeffrey and Chris of the Strong Style Story podcast, expanding their horizons to go beyond the land of the rising sun to talk about this AEW thing, which I don't really talk about the modern product all that much, but I feel like I should this week given all the stuff that's been going on. I did catch a little bit of AEW Dynamite last Wednesday. In fact, as I was finishing up the podcast, and by the way, I heard your complaint there, Keithy. I do know that there was some feedback on the audio, and I think I've addressed that. I just rebooted my computer, and apparently that solved the problem. Thing is, my laptop is so old that it takes a while, and it's a whole project to reboot it. Anyway, so I was watching a little bit of AEW, and I'm not sure how I felt about the former Jack Swagger being the big surprise at the end. I mean, I can't really, you know, judge it based on 1 week. I'm probably going to continue watching, especially if they get a one-hour Saturday night show on TBS at 6:05 p.m. Eastern Time. Please, pretty please. That's really all I want out of this, where you just have the mid-card wrestling on those shows, like Young Bucks, Cody, Omega. Keep them away from the Saturday night show. I just want, like, all the mid-carders on that. And hell, we'll even bring back Jimmy Hart. Let him book the entire thing like it was WCW Saturday Night from 1999. So I have to say, I enjoyed watching it. There was no Mauro Ranallo screaming Mamma Mia every 30 seconds. So it was nice in that perspective. You get Tony Schiavone there, which certainly gave it the feel of Nitro. And I was starting to have flashbacks with all the people running in at the end, thinking it was a 1997 Nitro. I was expecting Sting to come down from the rafters, like, oh my God, they're actually going to do that? But, you know, I guess it's been 20 years, and maybe you can actually bring a guy down from the ceiling safely these days. But I certainly will give that a watch again if I'm around to watch it. Now, as for SmackDown on Fox, which I still cannot believe that WWE is on network television in the year 2019, but they did draw nearly 4 million viewers for it, which from a network standpoint is pretty damn good these days. Yes, a far cry from Hogan Andre, 33 million back in the day, but the landscape has definitely changed in the last 31 years. Now, it's going to go down, certainly. You have the draft episode this week, which, if there's one trope in WWE that I just don't enjoy that others do seem to enjoy, well, one of them is Money in the Bank, and the other is the draft, because I remember that first 2002 draft and just being so confused by it that, oh, now you're going to make me watch two shows to see all the people? Screw that. I'm not doing that. So I actually stopped watching at that exact point in 2002. Not that I'm, you know, never going to watch the product now. Which brings me to the Hell in the Cell pay-per-view. Is it Hell in the Cell? I guess it's Hell in a Cell rather than... I always say Hell in the Cell. And I should actually know better because I went to that pay-per-view when it was in Boston in 2016. The Twizzlers cage was certainly very interesting. I think it would be better if you had like a Bastion Booger guy around these days who would just come down and try to eat it. To see, oh, I thought it was actually made out of licorice. Sorry. It could be like something for an R-Truth, but you really needed to be more of a Bastion Booger type. Like, oh, I thought it was candy. I'm sorry, the way that it's lit is like that. Now, I watched the finish to the Bray Wyatt-Seth Rollins match on mute, and I'm glad that I did, because I was able to get that screenshot where the screen was just black, and it said, on the closed captioning, it said, crowd booing. Well, I guess it's funny from that perspective, but really, have we learned nothing from Capital Combat 90 that DQ finishes in cage matches are definitely unsatisfying? I mean, speaking of Nitros from 1997, my God, that it's like AEW does that at the end, like a Nitro from 97, and WWE's like, hold my beer, and they're going to do this whole Bray Wyatt thing at the end with the sledgehammers and all that. Now, watching it on mute without the benefit of Vic Joseph or whoever telling me where they're trying to go with this storyline struck me as a double turn that seemed to have failed miserably. And you know me, I love double turns that kind of confuse people because they had one at Survivor Series 88, but not in this case. No, I really don't think so. And, you know, honestly, I should just stay in my lane when it comes to professional wrestling because there's going to be something in the modern product that I'm really going to latch on to. I feel like it's going to happen soon because of all the stuff that's out there with now AEW, with WWE having shows on Monday and Friday. I like that it's more spread out now and not Monday and Tuesday. I might even give Impact a look on Tuesday nights. And hell, I'm going to the Chaotic Wrestling show on Friday, or at least I think I am tomorrow night as this show drops in Lowell, Massachusetts. I mean, I have time and it's, you know, in the town next to me, so I should just go. And I always love going to Chaotic Wrestling, but I'm just waiting for that something to come along to really kind of hook me in. But for now, I'm just going to stay in my lane and talk about 1990 NWA. This Power Hour, as I said, taped in Johnson City, Tennessee, a rather unusual venue. Did not tape a lot of TV here. In fact, it might have been the only time that they ever did this. And I think one way you could tell from that is how insane this crowd is, but particularly for the main event, which is the Four Horsemen, this is the Sting in the Four Horsemen era. Sting is teaming with Arn Anderson and Ric Flair, so you don't have a lot of six-man matches with those three guys, but you do here, and they're facing off against the Great Muta, course, he's about to leave, but Muta, this is his first run in the NWA. Dragon Master, who is definitely kind of an outlier in this match, and Buzz Sawyer, who definitely is in the top five of guys that I've grown to appreciate more and more since I have started doing this podcast. Now, Sting, as a member of the Four Horsemen, was certainly rushed. He got hurt anyway at Clash 10, as it turns out, but with the way that they turned Ric Flair and then the rest of the Horsemen against him, which just kind of seemed out of nowhere at the Clash. They were playing it up like, well, the title is going to remain in the Horseman family no matter what, because Sting is going to face Flair at Wrestle War 90 at the end of February on the pay-per-view. But they kind of just dropped that all of a sudden, it seems. And it just seems a little bit strange. But let's think of it from this perspective. What comes next if Sting wins the title at Wrestle War? I've always thought to myself, well, maybe he wouldn't win it there. He would win it at the next pay-per-view after that. But I don't think that would be the case in the end, because they're looking at the other side of the world and they're seeing that the Ultimate Warrior is facing Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania 6. And you want to get that title on Sting before the Warrior gets the title, because you don't want to be considered something of a copycat. You know, the guy with the face paint who started out in Mid-South in Memphis with Rick Bassman and all that. I mean, come on, it would just feel like you were imitating them. But was it too early to turn the Horsemen against Sting? Yeah, it probably was. But even in light of all that, what was Sting going to do after he had won the title? He would still have a lot of the same issues if Sting does go on to beat Flair, as we would have expected at Wrestle War, other than Lex Luger is the obvious opponent in the aftermath because he's chafing for the title shot at this point. That's kind of his storyline, because it's probably the logical thing to do with any U.S. champion who is the de facto number one contender. But Sting gets hurt at the Clash, blows out his knee, can't go. So now you got to turn Luger because they don't feel comfortable having anybody else in that spot. Well, you know, there are other people you could have thrown out there. Maybe just thrown Dr. Death out there once, had like a schmoz finish. Even a Brian Pillman. I mean, who knows, really? But Luger, Lex Luger, once again gets the shaft because of Sting. Not in that, oh, he didn't get to win the world title here, but because he was having such a good heel run that to cut it short like that after only 8 or 9 months, because he had only turned the previous June on Ricky Steamboat, which feels like Steamboat's a million miles away from the NWA at this point, but he was only there 8 months before. But this kind of makes me wonder one thing about Lex Luger, and I don't know if this applies as much to his WWF time, although it's a question I think should be asked there, is did he advocate for himself strongly enough in terms of his storylines and his character? Because it seems like he might have just been in kind of a go-along-to-get-along mode, which is a fine way to operate, I guess. But in the world of pro wrestling where, you know, he's around a guy like Flair who was constantly trying to undermine him, it would have been good if Luger had either stood up for himself more or had an advocate who would stand up for him on his behalf. But Lex was not exactly maybe the most likable guy in terms of the other boys, because he's a little bit different than a college boy, as opposed to some of the territory wrestlers who, you know, just kind of hate everyone and everything to do with that world. So this is a fun little two-month era, just taking it between Starrcade and when Sting gets hurt. Some of that stuff is actually on this show. You know, it's Sting in the Horsemen. We have Terry Funk calling matches on WCW Worldwide, but he also has an interview segment, Funk's Grill. I have not had one of those on Greetings from Allentown in quite some time, but once again, I love me some Terry Funk, so I am certainly glad that he's here, and sure enough, he has Sting on Funk's Grill this week, which certainly proves to be somewhat interesting. But also, you have Ole Anderson and Arn Anderson as babyfaces, which Ole Anderson as a babyface just kind of cracks me up, given, you know, you just think of him as literally the most I hate everyone else person in the entire world. But yep, there's this little period before they sent Ole to a farm upstate where he could run around in the fields and book bad ankles, not harm anybody, and just live a perfect life from then on. But on this show, you have the six-man. We're also going to see the Samoan Savage up first for whatever that's worth in the year 1990. We get the team of the Italian Stallion and Ranger Ross, pardon my editorial laugh, taking on the Freebirds. And don't get excited. There's no Terry Gordy at this point. It's Jimmy Garvin, who I know I just praised him for his work in 83 World Class, but 83 World Class Garvin ain't 90 NWA, yeah, Freebirds Garvin. They're just not the same guy. So, with all that in mind, let's get right to it. NWA Power Hour, January 26, 1990.
We're back, and we got us a blizzard here at Bud Bowl.
For Budweiser, it's down to one last play. 3 seconds left. They're down by four.
Come on, guys. Don't fizzle out on me now.
They need a touchdown.
They need a miracle.
Blue, 33.
It's Budweiser 36, Bud Light 34.
Freezer, back-to-back titles. How did you do it?
Let me tell you, man, nothing beats a Bud.
Once upon a time, about 30 years ago, when Super Bowls were routinely terrible, as it was in January of 1990, San Francisco beat Denver 55-10, I think it was, we would anticipate as a nation, and as the world, quite frankly, the Bud Bowl much more than the actual game. The matchup of, like, animatronic beer bottles of Budweiser versus Bud Light that would play out during a series of commercials, probably about 8 of them over the course of the game. And on this occasion, they unveiled the slogan, "Nothing Beats a Bud," as Budweiser defeated Bud Light 36-34 under somewhat shady circumstances. I mean, I think it was a forward fumble there at the end. I mean, don't they have a 2-minute warning in that? But I could tie this back to wrestling in one way, is you got Bud and Bud Light in the Bud Bowl, and they played 8 of those things over the years, and Bud prevailed in 6 of the 8. So clearly, whoever was in charge of this, of booking the Bud Bowl at Anheuser-Busch, definitely had Budweiser as their favorite, much the same as Vince McMahon always had Monday Night Raw as his baby, because that predated SmackDown. And another similarity is Budweiser and Raw, known for the color red, Bud Light, and SmackDown, the color blue. So Budweiser equals Raw, Bud Light equals SmackDown. Of course, I don't really like either of them at this point. But I'm not indicting the modern product or anything. I'm just making that observation. So as we start NWA Power Hour, which would air on Friday night on TBS and then re-air at some point on Saturday, our announcers for this program are Jim Ross and Jim Cornette. And I am so glad to have a Jim Cornette show, because it's been a long time since I had him as an announcer. He is in rare form on this one, particularly in the intro. I don't know if he was just re-energized by turning heel again some 2-3 months before this, after that whole unfortunate Dynamic Dudes business where Cornette was like, yeah, I might be managing them or advising them, but then finally turning on them and going back to leading only the Midnight Express. But through 1988 and 89, Jim Cornette was the greatest babyface manager of all time. That's something that's very, very hard to pull off. So as I've mentioned, this was taped in Johnson City, Tennessee, which they make sure to make note of in the open. And Jim Cornette certainly has his fun with that location.
We are in Johnson City, Tennessee.
Where are you finding these places? First it was Peoria, Illinois. Then we went to Gainesville, Georgia. Now Johnson City, Tennessee. I'm glad Bucks, North Tennessee doesn't have a civic center. We'd be there too. How about Oil Trough, Texas? Sound familiar?
This is America's first frontier. Today when I got in town, I went on the Wilderness Walk, Daniel Boone's Wilderness Walk. I went to Jonesboro, Tennessee's oldest town, the home of Andrew Jackson. But I didn't get to go by Davy Crockett's birthplace.
Why in the world would you want to see where David Crockett was born? Took you long enough to get him off the announcing staff around here.
Well,
oh, yeah!
It's amazing how funny Jim Cornette can be when he's not focused on being so angry about everything. He clearly says to Jim Ross before, make sure you see something about Davy Crockett's birthplace so I can crack on David Crockett as an announcer. Oh, that's the good stuff right there. But for all of his remarks about where they are in Tennessee, this is the show that gave him the idea that, oh, well, maybe if someday I could start a promotion that runs East Tennessee and I could draw hot crowds just like the one here. So this kind of changed wrestling in a certain way because this would lead to the formation of Smoky Mountain Wrestling. About a year and a half down the line is when that pilot is shot, but it's 92 to 95 is the main years of Smoky Mountain Wrestling. Yeah, more busting balls, Cornette, less calling everybody a horrible person and wishing for them to die. That's all that I ask for. So why don't we just go right into our first match? It's Samoan Savage with the Big Kahuna, a.k.a. Oliver Humperdinck. So clearly I'm rolling my eyes, and you can just sense that from the way I'm talking about him. Facing off against Robbie Idol, who when I saw this, I was excited. I was like, oh, is this Rob Van Dam in WCW? No, that's Robbie V. This is Robbie Idol, who is no relation to Billy Idol, which is how it's spelled, and obviously no relation to Eric Idol, because they spell their names completely differently. The Samoan Savage, for those of you who might not be familiar with his work at WCW, and I could see why that would happen, because he's not there for an incredibly long period of time and doesn't really make any sort of memorable impact. The question for the former Tama in the Islanders in the WWF and the former Tonga Kid before that is, how far can he fall? He was a young talent coming up in 1983, would eventually be put alongside Jimmy Snuka when that was something that really meant something in the business, kind of playing his proxy when Snuka was out for a little while in 84 at some point. I don't know if he was selling the coconut thing, but he had matches against his future Body Slam co-star, Roddy Piper. Yes, the Tonga Kid, the Samoan Savage, he was in Body Slam. Now, there's a movie I need to watch. And speaking of which, I need to actually watch movies that I say that I'm going to watch, because I said I was going to watch Rattle and Hum, never got around to it, and I don't even own Body Slam. So maybe at some point, maybe I can do a podcast on Body Slam. It doesn't feel like there's been a lot on that. So I think he's being, in this case now, he got fired from the WWF or quit or whatever in 1988, but loses his spot in the Islanders. I think right now he's being karmically punished by being with 1990 Oliver Humperdinck. I don't know about you, but let's think about where Humperdinck was after that 87-88 WWF run. He's hanging out with the Freebirds in 91, like the least likable version of the Freebirds from any objective standard. I don't know. I think he's the kind of guy you should keep your distance from. And we have an inset promo, Lord help us, from the Samoan Savage's Clash 10 opponent. And I was wondering, did he actually face Dr. Death Steve Williams? Did this match actually come off? And I got it confused with the Dr. Death was supposed to face Luger for the U.S. title at WrestleWar. That never happened. And that's the match that I got confused with that. But in fact, Steve Williams did face the Samoan Savage on that show. And like I said, buckle up, everybody. We got a Dr. Death promo.
Meep. What's up, Doc?
Whoa! What is it? What is it? Is it a tornado? Is it the Tasmanian Devil? Or is it Dr. Death? Class of champions, Dr. Death is walking down the aisle against Samoan Savage for a 1-2-3.
Well, that did absolutely nothing to make me think that Dr. Death is drug-free, but okay, I'll put that aside, even with the creepy music that I couldn't quite figure out, because Samoan Savage is not doing a lot to capture my imagination in this match. So, thankfully, we have JR and Jim Cornette, the latter of whom basically turns this into a future episode of Jim Cornette's Drive-In.
Mil Mascaris has signed to be on that big event as well.
How do you say that?
Mil Mascaris.
I don't speak Mexican. I'm not sure exactly how to say it.
Did you ever order fajitas? Just roll the R's.
I don't eat that stuff. You can't tell what's in there. I like to eat plain American food like meatloaf and mashed potatoes, where you can tell what all the ingredients are right off the bat.
The Samoan Savage will take on Robbie Idol here momentarily.
I left that last part in because I don't know if that's the transfer of the tape or a TBS blooper of some kind where Jim Ross gets the kind of echo effect, the Lou Gehrig on the field at Yankee Stadium. Today, I consider myself pinch hitting for Pedro Barbon, Manny Mota. I don't know. That actually happens a couple of times in the show, but Jim Cornette is to food as I am to baseball. Like, just randomly, you know, bringing it up out of nowhere. I mean, nobody really asked what the deal with the Mexican food is. Yes, there is a match going on. As Idol gets a little bit of an edge on the Samoan Savage early, working the left arm, as Cornette says that Idol can be taken semi-lightly in this one. Can't take him lightly, but you can take him semi-lightly. As the Samoan Savage puts his head down, a cardinal mistake by a ring veteran, but because he's Samoan, the kick to the head has absolutely no effect on him. See, it's the thing that I said last week. The Samoans are only going to sell headshots for each other. And because Idol isn't part of the club, well, he doesn't get that benefit. And a sidekick by the Samoan Savage, we get a close-up of Hump out at ringside, Oliver Humperdinck, Big Kahuna, whatever the hell he's calling himself. I did not need that close-up, so that's two production snafus we've had so far. Leg drop by Samoan Savage. I am just not into this at all. I mean, I'm not going to start reading, you know, Freak Like Me lyrics or anything like that. It's just that the Samoan Savage had fallen from where the expectation was just 5 to 7 years earlier. I mean, he was in a freaking movie with Roddy Piper. I mean, why... why did he have to like drugs so much? Allegedly, of course. I actually knew a guy whose last name was Savage. No, not Randy, but he was 3 years ahead of me in high school. He was known for his ability to pick up women in Target. This was as an adult. He wasn't doing that in high school. And the fact that it actually worked was pretty impressive, but he later, about 10 years ago, I went to Buffalo for a Patriots-Bills game. And my friend had Savage's jersey that was personalized. His wife had gotten him a Patriots jersey personalized with Savage on the back. But the number was number 08. Yes, 08. Rarely do you ever see anything like that in any sport. Although, Benito Santiago, who was once of the San Diego Padres, later the Florida Marlins, wore number 09. And when asked why he was wearing 09 instead of 9, he said, well, I wear the 0 for balance. But 08 on a football jersey definitely looked weird. And the Bills fans constantly yelling, Savage, you suck, at my friend who happened to be wearing the other guy's jersey. So it is more interesting than anything the Samoan Savage is doing in the ring with this Idol character. Jim Ross and Jim Cornette, what a good team they are together. And, you know, they know that they don't have a lot to work with in there. So, and it's, you know, the Friday night show on TBS. Who really gives a crap? I mean, the Power Hour, that's a drinking game. That's not a wrestling show. So while we're here, unsolicited, please, Cornette, tell us about Samoan women.
Or is it hereditary? Is it environment? Or is it genes that causes these Samoan people to be so cat-like, so strong, well, so mean?
Near a fall there, Corny.
So
and they
ugly.
Picked up.
Ugly.
I see some beautiful Samoan women, but they're men or not. They're men.
Where? No,
women.
Now tell me, now just come on, right now. Where have you seen one beautiful Samoan woman?
In Samoa.
Where, when was the last time you happened to traipse through Samoa on your way to the corner store to get a loaf of bread?
Lateral press on top, 1-2. I'll tell you about it off. We'll get off the air.
In Samoa. I guess your old World War II Army days.
No, not that old.
And but the stories you tell are...
when the action in the ring ain't that good, and with this being an extended squash by a less-than-dynamic version of the Samoan Savage, you need good announcers like Jim Ross and Jim Cornette to kind of keep you engaged with what's going on, especially since this is the first match of the show. I mean, it would be very easy to turn it off and do something else. Hell, it would be very easy for me to shut this off and do a completely different show, but then I would miss out on the six-man later on. So Jim Ross, Jim Cornette are keeping me tuned in for that, and thank God for that. We get a pile driver that looks like a power bomb, and Samoan Savage is doing that thing where he pulls the guy up at two. A clothesline. I mean, Jim Cornette's jokes are the best thing about this, as Jim Ross actually plugs the Cornette version of the hotline. Each person would have a specific day of the week on the WCW hotline, and they show the big kahuna, Oliver Humperdinck, at ringside. And once again, Cornette delights me by explaining why he isn't exactly close with that man.
I would say nothing's bothering me. You know, I like Hump. He's a nice kind of guy, but sometimes that voice, he's a little grainy, a little grating. Just my opinion.
And this is where I wish Jim Ross had a little bit better of a sense of humor. Yes, he gives Cornette a playground to do all of his bits, but, you know, the pushback there would have been like, really, Corny? Really? An annoying voice? Really? You're the one who's going to say that? That's what he should have said there. But so, oh no, we got to get back to pushing this Samoan Savage match. It's so important. He does the power slam off the Irish Whip, only gets 4 Teds out of 10, and pulls the guy up at 2 because we haven't done that enough. But to go back to that, I love it when heel managers bicker with each other, like when Heenan would be about to call Jimmy Hart a pipsqueak, but then he would make it so he was like gonna cough instead of calling him a pipsqueak. He did that several times. He does, now, I will say this for the Samoan Savage. He does do one good move, which is his finisher. Maybe I'm just biased because it actually finished this match, which feels like it felt forever. He puts Idol in the bonsai drop position like Yokozuna would do, but instead he comes off like a swagger bomb, but instead hits a flying headbutt. So a different sort of way of getting that headbutt off the second rope, which is what it was. And finally, mercifully, that picks up the win here. It's way too freaking long, and I'm usually disposed to like this guy, but then again, that's, you know, years before this, and clearly he's just past his sell-by date. It's sad, but true.
Hey, homeboy, gather around. Some serious stuff is gonna go down on the Wrestle War Diet. The Kings of the Ring all come together and do the wild thing. Lex Luger, the stylish Nature Boy Sting, yeah, they all be doing that. Sting, yeah, they all be there with something to prove. Brimming with intentions to bust the move. It's pay-per-view excitement for THE. For more information, call your cable company.
Anytime WCW would do a rap song to promote their upcoming pay-per-view, it made me infinitely more likely to purchase said pay-per-view. It worked for the Great American Bash 91 with the on July 14th, see the WCW crew. I've covered that. I did not remember that there was one for Wrestle War 90, and anyway, I really wasn't watching the product in real time at this point. But is that better or worse than the PN News rap for 1991? Some of it seems a little hacky, but I give them bonus points for rhyming THE, Turner Home Entertainment, with Cable Company. I feel like there was some decent writing there at the end, so at least they finished strong.
He's wrestling's most respected journalist, and he's got all the wrestling news that's fit to print. It's time for the Wrestling News Network. Let's go to WNN and Gordon Solie.
Wait a minute, I thought that they were going to say that Dave Meltzer was wrestling's most respected journalist, not Gordon Solie. How can Gordon Solie lay claim to that when he doesn't even know Frank DeFord? Did you know that Dave Meltzer knows Frank DeFord? You know how you can find that out? Just talk to Dave Meltzer for 3 minutes, and I'm sure he'll bring it up. I don't hate Meltzer like some of those other Twitter accounts that are out there that, you know, do entertain me, because Meltzer has certainly gone off the deep end with his ridiculous Twitter persona. I'm particularly glad, you know, his chronicling of the history of wrestling in the 80s and 90s. Fine, did an excellent job with that. Did get a lot of stuff wrong, but to call himself like the Edward R. Murrow, you know, wrestling is not exactly the easiest place for journalism, because you are covering people who are basically lying about what they're doing, particularly, you know, when they were trying to keep kayfabe. So, I don't know. Maybe there should be a different sort of word for it. Wrestling coverage is really kind of a strange thing. So, we get Gordon, and he's going to tell us what's coming up not only on the Clash of Champions 10 and on February 6th live on TBS, but also for WrestleWar 90 on pay-per-view later in the month. For the Clash, it's really weird to think of the Dragon Master as being part of the main event, but he's also main eventing this edition of Power Hour as well, so what can I really say about that?
The World Heavyweight Championship goes on the line. Ric Flair, who has held the NWA World Heavyweight Championship on numerous occasions, defending his title against one of the horsemen, Sting. It is a world title match, and it will take place, as we said, of course, on the 25th.
Oh, it's nobody's fault that Sting got hurt. It was an accident, right? Well, you could blame the booking committee and point the finger directly at Ric Flair and his desire to, I have to go back to being a heel as soon as possible. You have to think that he's driving that decision. And if that does not happen, well, then this is a pretty easy butterfly effect we're talking about here, where Sting, they don't do the thing where they have to pull him off the damn cage if the horsemen don't turn on him in that show. It basically set up the entire thing. Although, you could say maybe his knee was a ticking time bomb. I don't know about that, not the way that he landed. It's not like his knee was going to blow out at any second, so I don't know. It's just one of those what-ifs, but we haven't even gotten to the best part of these Wrestling News Network segments with Gordon Solie, and that's that he would talk about other promotions, and in this case, he's talking about the merger of the CWA and the USWA in Memphis, but then, for whatever reason, decides to take a giant dump on Memphis.
The USWA and the CWA have merged, which means that Dallas and Memphis will now be exchanging wrestling talent from town to town and from match to match. And I might just point out, not to worry for those of you in Memphis, the NWA, the senior league in professional wrestling, will be in Memphis next Thursday night, February 1st. Look for all of your top TV stars in action.
And yes, WCW did come to Memphis on February 1st and drew a crowd of 5,500 to the Mid-South Coliseum, so far from a sellout, but not completely terrible, in my opinion. And here's the card that they put on there. Mike Rotunda, who is not yet a captain, I don't think, pinned Rager Ross. The Dynamic Dudes defeated Jack Victory and Rip Morgan. Norman pinned Kevin Sullivan. Rock and Roll Express defeated the Midnight Express. The Road Warriors and the Steiner Brothers defeated Doom and the Skyscrapers, Skyscrapers being Mark Callis and Dan Spivey by this point, in the main event, NWA World Champion Ric Flair, still a babyface, pinned U.S. Champion Lex Luger. So, not the worst card in the world. You got Flair, Luger, Midnight's Rock and Rolls, you got that eight-man tag, and then you also have Norman and Kevin Sullivan and a few others as well. Gordon closes out the segment by talking about the recent death of Haystacks Calhoun, who had actually died in December of 89, but just a bit of a requiem for the 600-pounder from Rogers Corner, Arkansas. Or was it Victory Corner, Arkansas? No, it's Morgan's Corner, Arkansas. Completely fictional place, I might add. I was kind of disappointed to find that out. But in his tribute to him, he said he spent a lot on health for his family, which I don't know what that means. Food at the supermarket. I mean, after all, he was a 600-pound man.
The stars of the NWA are coming to your area. Thursday, February 8th, Temple Belt in Texas, Bell Expo Center, Lex Luger and Muda.
You bought a ticket to that show to see the great Muda. You would have been very disappointed because he had quit and gone back to Japan after the Clash on the 6th. The show the next night, they were in Belton on the 8th, and on the 9th in San Antonio, Texas. This is from history at WWE.com. NWA World Champion Ric Flair, Sting, the Great Muta, Steve Williams, and U.S. Champion Lex Luger did not appear as advertised for various reasons. Flair was tending to his ill wife. Yes, because Flair is such a family man. Okay, I'll take that at face value. Sting was hurt, of course, at the Clash. Muta had quit. Dr. Death was in Japan, and Luger had transportation problems. A banner night for the NWA in San Antonio at the Hemisphere Arena, which was capped off by Road Warrior Hawk winning a 24-man battle royal, which basically everybody in the back goes in the ring. Even you, Doug Dillinger, get in there. We're going to throw you out over the top. But the show in Temple, Texas there, which is next to Belton. My wife has relatives in Temple. And I went to a wedding there, actually two separate weddings. And in 2010, the place we went to, it was a big barn. And there was some flooding issues there. But the thing that spooked me at that one was, in the middle of the reception, some mariachis showed up out of nowhere. And this made sense because the man that my wife's cousin, I think it was marrying, was of Mexican descent. So, okay, well, yeah, we brought in mariachis. No, apparently the mariachis came to the wrong wedding, which led to my wife and I coining the term accidental mariachis, which sounds like the name of some kind of alternative band that might be opening for Dave Matthews or some crap like that. Anyway, mariachis scare the hell out of me because of this one time I was in a Mexican restaurant and this guy was playing whatever instrument it was, and he was giving me the same look that like Luke Harper does. You remember him? He was on WWF. Oh, I guess he's on there again more recently, but he had kind of like the wide bug eyes and was really kind of creeping me out. Anyway, back to the NWA. It's funny how not only are they going through Memphis, but they're basically doing the old Mid-South loop through Texas and that whole area, talking about Oklahoma City a little bit later. But as they're plugging the house shows, when they put up the one for Charleston, South Carolina, at the bottom, they meant to say scattered locations for tickets where you can purchase them, but they actually abbreviated scattered to just scat locations for tickets. So like, oh, what do you have to sit in feces to come to these? No wonder why house show attendance was so down in the NWA. They made some people think that there was actual feces in the crowd. They were literally working scat. So as we go back, Jim Ross and Cornette are at the broadcast area, I would guess. The way the NWA would do it is almost like they're on like the interview platform, but Jim Cornette's a little distracted. He's kind of reading something and kind of reacting humorously to what's going on.
What do you got there, Cornette?
This is one of these hot love letters from one of the women writing about the Midnight Express, beautiful Bobby and Sweet Stan.
That's from the Happy Days nursing home, isn't it? The stationery.
Well, women of all ages like the Midnight Express. What are we doing here?
A good comedian has to be able to bust his own balls every so often. You can't just be taking shots at everybody else. So Cornette having a little bit of fun at his own expense. I guess he's done commentary this week, I saw, for this NWA Power thing that is somewhere. I'm going to have to track that down. I had to put the at the end because there's a lot of R's. I don't know what they're trying to accomplish with that, but all I know is that in the Boston area, that's probably not going to play having too many R's at the end. So they now discuss an incident from the January 20th edition of Worldwide, so just 1 week before, featuring the new Skyscrapers beating up Scott Steiner in the ring, and Animal is getting pounded down as well by members of Doom. Apparently, Skyscrapers and Doom have some sort of alliance under the guise of Teddy Long, so I guess that makes sense. Hawk isn't there for whatever reason. It doesn't matter, and Rick doesn't make the save for a little bit, so it's a pretty good heel beatdown, but they definitely want to talk about, well, there's no Sid there in the Skyscrapers, so they had to find a replacement for him.
What about that new Skyscraper, Mean Mark Callis? He's callous, he's cruel, he's evil. You know what a callus is, don't you? It's raw, it's tough, it's rough, it's on your hand there, it kind of sore.
You must have read about it.
Sure, a lot of synonyms there.
You think
there.
Teddy Long made a mistake in replacing the Sid Vicious?
No.
Quite frankly.
What do you do with a horse when he breaks his leg? You shoot him. If Sid Vicious couldn't be of use to Teddy Long, but I'm sure when he comes back, when he gets back in shape, he can be of use to Teddy. Can you imagine what that guy would look like with those French maids outfit carrying a drink?
I don't know what happened to that Mean Mark Callis guy. He must have passed away in the fall of 1990 because I don't remember him ever turning up anywhere else. But when Sid would come back, he would be wearing a French maid outfit, although that would be a very interesting look for him, I have to admit. I would pay money to see Sid wearing that, but instead he would be wearing the tuxedo and looking menacingly in the background of Four Horsemen promos, which is also very, very good. As I mentioned back in episode 45, that's what got him to join the Horsemen, an extended clothing allowance that allowed him to buy those tuxedos that he could wear for all those interviews. Yes, I actually went back and listened to episode 45 so I can remember what my bit was there. I really don't like to repeat things. So they show the clip from Worldwide, and they're early 1990 NWA Worldwide's with Chris Cruz as the announcer, my hero from WCW Prime alongside Dusty Rhodes. Well, no Dusty Rhodes here. In fact, we get the exact opposite with Terry Funk, who apparently was in charge of the syndicated TV at this point, Terry was, but he kind of got pushed out because, well, he took a look around and saw Ole Anderson gaining power. He's like, well, Ole's a bit of an a-hole, so I'm going to get out of here and go back to Amarillo. Probably a pretty smart move to get out of Dodge, given all of the circumstances. But I heard through the grapevine that whatever episodes that exist of NWA Worldwide from 90 with Cruz and Funk on commentary, nobody seems to have them, except for Chris Cruz himself. Now, I don't think he listens to this program. I'm a fan of Chris Cruz's work through the years, but I know he probably doesn't want to put any of them online or anything, but all I'm asking, just one episode. It doesn't have to be, nothing has to happen in any of it. I just want to be able to cover one episode of NWA Worldwide from early 1990. Now, I'm going to have to wait at least 10 weeks because I'm not going to do the exact same time period of the NWA after doing this show. It's just the way I do things.
That was Callis off the top rope.
Big Clark Callis up on that top rope off with that flying elbow.
Fans were trying to call this for you, but the action just doesn't stop. It's everywhere. Apparently now all seven in the ring.
Spivey on top of him. They're doubling up on Animal right now. They're continuing to double up on him. Look at Teddy Long.
Oh, a stuffed pile driver. And this looks like a power bomb.
Oh, power bomb right there. Teddy Long is directing traffic from the ringside right there. Mr. Potato Head. He's picking him back up again even after that power slam.
Clearly, Terry, this was a mistake for the Steiners and Road Warrior Animal to go. Well, look, there's Rick.
Here
he comes. Chair.
Here
he comes. Maybe the equalizer.
He's going to try to clear that ring right now.
Or perhaps I could just be an adult and accept the fact that not every show from every era is going to be available at all times. I mean, even though we are in the 21st century and everything is on demand, maybe those early 90 NWA Worldwides, we're just not going to see them. So why don't I just move on to the next match, which is the Freebirds of Jimmy Garvin and Michael Hayes are taking on the team of Ranger Ross and the Italian Stallion. Now, for those of you who are more familiar with last week's product, the 1984 WWF, to kind of translate that into that language, Ranger Ross translates roughly into SD Jones, which I know is making the, you know, racial comparison where, oh, I have to go black guy to black guy, but they're pretty much on the same level where, yeah, Ranger Ross would pick up a few wins here and there, and SD Jones would win here and there, and, you know, that sort of way. Italian Stallion, very clean connection. Sal Bellomo on the other side in the WWF would be his rough equivalent. Freebirds are feuding with Z-Man, Tom Zenk, and Brian Pillman, apparently as part of the make sure we tie up Brian Pillman in any sort of tag team so that we can't push him as a single in case something happens to Sting program. It's very long and cumbersomely worded, but that's the way WCW did things. I know I've said in the past, oh, there's no shame in being a great tag team wrestler, but it's not like any of the tag teams that Pillman was in, they decided, oh, well, clearly we're going to go all the way with this thing because the Hollywood Blondes, they cut their balls off after a few months, and Z-Man and Brian Pillman, I'm not so sure I would feel good teaming with the Z-Man considering this is his first high-profile tag team since the Can-Am Connection debacle of mid-87 where he just kind of walks out. Anyway, enough about those guys. I'm going to focus on who's on the match. Now, Jim Cornette has some opinions on Ranger Ross, and in fact, it kind of comments on the odd team of Ranger Ross and the Italian Stallion. Wonder, first of all, what is the Ranger doing there? And has an idea. I don't know if this is something he pitched to the booking committee.
Ranger Ross has no business being in the ring with any of these guys. We fought Italy in World War II. If Ross is such a proud American, he shouldn't be partners with the Stallion. And the Freebirds are from Alabama. They're from the South, just like Lynyrd Skynyrd. They fought on the side of the Confederacy. So they shouldn't be in the ring with Ranger Ross either.
Thank you so much for that history lesson. And boys and girls, we'll have another one next Friday.
I'll tell you what's going to happen. The Stallion's going to turn on Ranger Ross. and the Freebirds and the Stallion are going to pound the bejesus out of Ranger Ross. That's what's going to happen.
All right, well, we'll wait and see.
There's a couple of things Cornette gets wrong there. Freebirds are not from Alabama. They're from Georgia. You know, Bad Street, Atlanta, GA. It's in the freaking song. But I think Cornette's forgetting, yes, we did fight against Italy, the United States did, in World War II. But don't forget that Italy had a face turn around 1944 where they threw Mussolini off the balcony. I don't know, Italian history isn't my strength. But yes, they did turn face towards the end of World War II. It was kind of like, I want to say Kurt Angle during the invasion angle, if I remember correctly. It's something like that. So I don't know exactly what he was getting at. I like the JR with the quick nice little history lesson there. But did he really pitch an angle where the Italian Stallion would turn heel and beat up Ranger Ross? I mean, that would be a bottom of the card feud. Although, really, was anybody wanting to boo the Italian Stallion? I mean, he's such a lovable guy, or so it seems. But yes, Ranger Ross should just hate absolutely everybody. And he could become 1996 Steve Austin if given the right opportunity, but they just missed the boat on good old Ranger Ross, who starts out with Hayes, and he kind of takes him over to the mat, and then Ranger Ross does a little bit of a wiggle, because Hayes was doing his moonwalk thing very timely in 1990, and Ranger Ross is doing the Arsenio thing to the dog pound, and that is timely, at least for Greetings from Allentown purposes. And then Ranger Ross blocks a hip lock, which, and then does the wiggle again, giving somewhere Norman Smiley is having ideas, just kind of watching along. Because, you know, he'll be in the NWA late in 1990. He'll be at Starrcade at some point for that weird tag team Pat O'Connor Memorial Tournament. Garvin gets in there, but with little success, and he is met with a drop kick, and Hayes is as well when he comes into the ring. So the Freebirds are sent out to the floor. Ranger Ross gets to stand tall for a little bit as the Birds are now asking that the Italian sausage, quote-unquote, that is their words, be brought into the ring. I don't know if that's a reference to his heritage, what the food he likes to eat, or perhaps his genitalia. I don't know. But now, the Italian Stallion. Jim Cornette's had a lot of fun, you know, making fun of guys and busting balls earlier on in this show, but now Jim Ross wants to get in on the fun at the expense of the Italian Stallion.
Archie Bunker would have loved the Italian Stallion.
Yeah,
he gives more meaning to the term meathead. Hey, he's a real likable guy, but he's just not going to set any IQ records. Great athlete, though. That's true, as a matter of fact. He won his letter in football. He had to have somebody read it to him.
All right, fine. Italian Stallion might not be the brightest bulb on the tree, but he is one of the all-time great spaghetti eaters, because he did set the record for eating the pound of spaghetti faster than anybody else. I'm not sure what the standards are for that or the sanctioning body. What I do know is that I'm still, after 3 years of SunTrust Park in Atlanta being open, I'm still the sushi-eating champion of the Delta Club at 39 pieces for one game. I dare anybody to try and match that one, as Hayes is pushed down. So the Freebirds stall a little bit more outside the ring, and we get a top wrist lock battle into a side headlock, but then a belly-to-belly by the Italian Stallion, busting that one out. So Ross tags back in, and now Garvin is in the ring, gets some knees to the gut, but reversal of an Irish whip leads to a blind tag, and now Hayes is in there and hits Ranger Ross with a pretty hilarious left, where Ross is just kind of like, duh, and Hayes just nails him with that left hand, and Ross ends up outside the ring. But then back in, it's Garvin, and he puts his head down, a cardinal mistake for a ring veteran, yes, and Hayes does get back in, and now we get the lukewarm tag to the Italian Stallion. And he is just a house of pizza when he gets in there. I mean, a house of fire. And Garvin, when he goes for a pin, the Stallion, Garvin ends up breaking it up. So now all four men are in the ring. You get a collision between Hayes and Ranger Ross. And then the Stallion makes the same mistake we saw earlier in the match on the other side. He puts his head down, a cardinal mistake for a... All right, maybe he's not quite the ring veteran, but with the referee distracted by Ranger Ross now down on the floor, or getting back up to the apron, the Freebirds take advantage, hit the double DDT on Stallion, And that is how they pick up the 1-2-3 in this one. It's not the greatest thing in the world, but once again, it's saved by Jim Ross and Jim Cornette just kind of making me laugh through this match. I mean, it's a thing that happened, I guess. This version of the Freebirds is definitely past its prime, shall we say. I'm not particularly interested in seeing Jimmy Garvin at this point, especially since I've now seen the better parts of his career in 83 and 87. I don't need to see 92, 92 Jimmy Garvin anymore.
Things are heating up on the Power Hour. The grill is getting hot. Now let's go to Terry Funk and Funk's Grill.
Howdy, you simple-minded partners. I want once again to welcome you to Funk's Grill, and I've got some fatherly advice for my special guest today. Because I think that this young wrestler is possibly in the future going to be the richest wrestler in the world. So come on in here, Sonny.
Since I can't watch any of those worldwides from early 1990, it's nice to have Terry Funk on this show in some capacity, even if it's on Funk's Grill with that kind of weird set where it's just the neon on lighting that says Funk's Grill and it's not done in front of an audience or anything. It makes me wonder, I mean, could they have dressed this up a little bit and, you know, given it some kind of set? You can even have it in a studio. You don't even have to bring the set to the arena, but I have an idea of where they could have purchased something. And I'm thinking back once again to 1984 WWF because my mind is still stuck on that because I think it always is, but mainly because I did that show last week. But from the end of 1984, there was a talk show hosted by Blackjack Mulligan that appeared on All-Star Wrestling called Blackjack's Barbecue. And I feel that the set of Blackjack's Barbecue would fit perfectly well for Funk's Grill. And let's think about this now. Right around this time, early in 1990, Blackjack Mulligan is in trouble for counterfeiting and that whole business with his son Kendall. And they're probably in need of money to pay for lawyers. So at a distressed property auction, they could pay real American money and get the Blackjack's Barbecue set and import that to the NWA. I don't know. I'm just throwing the idea out there because it's better than just that stupid black background with the neon thing that says Funk's Grill. So he's got some fatherly advice for Sting, and it's kind of bittersweet watching him here. I mean, we're going to see him in action later in the six-man, but watching him at this particular point in his career, January of 1990, where he's got that knee injury just around the corner at the Clash, it's like watching Steve Austin's match with Owen Hart at SummerSlam 97 before they did the ridiculous pile driver spot, which is incredibly irresponsible because Austin already had a freaking neck injury pre-existing from earlier in that year. That's neither here nor there. It's just thinking, what could have been with Sting? It's like he was the good, relatable Ultimate Warrior. Like, the Ultimate Warrior for people who wanted guys who'd speak to them in English, but also be goofy and charming and endearing. And he walks on the side, woo! He's like my cat walking into my bedroom in the morning. You know, like, I want food! That's Sting for you.
Well, I want to ask you, first of all, do you actually believe that Ric Flair is taking you down the right track? I mean, he's taking you down a one-way road to destruction. I'm telling you, he's putting you in a train, and he's putting you in the fast lane because you are going out with all of these wild women. You are staying up all night long. You are doing all of this drinking and all of this crossing that I would like to be doing, but I can do it
because sounds to me, Terry Funk, like you're trying to stir it up between the Four Horsemen, the Sting, and the Nature Boy, Arn Anderson, Ole Anderson. Why are you doing that? You know it's not true. You know that the most important thing to the Four Horsemen for a long time has been the world title. So you see, if I beat Ric Flair for that world title, or if he beats me for it, it's still going to be part of the Four Horsemen family.
Somewhat fashionable to call Sting stupid, and how could he have not expected the Horsemen to turn on him in this situation? Some of the stuff later on, maybe you can fault him for that. But here, I think his logic is just a little bit flawed in that kings don't just abdicate their throne for nothing. Like, Ric Flair isn't going to be not upset if he loses the world title to Sting. He's not going to be able to just sit back and associate with him in the same club. He's not thinking through the consequences. Like I said, kings don't just abdicate the throne for nothing, unless, of course, they're Edward VIII, and they're going to, you know, abdicate as the King of England in 1936 and go out and marry American Wallis Simpson, who I can only imagine that she was a demon and a half in the sack. I mean, there's absolutely no way that I would abdicate the throne. I mean, I'm just saying that from my perspective. So for Flair, even that, I mean, you know, he's, even though they're in the same group, He's not going away. It's not like, oh, if Sting wins the title, that there's not going to be a rematch. So I don't think he thought this thing through. So this gets a little bizarre, because now Terry is digging in. He's not quite digging in the claws the way like a Jesse Ventura would, but he's kind of needling Sting about the whole horseman oeuvre, because he's a horseman now, about money and alcohol. And our hero, Sting, once again, now, I don't know if this makes him awkward or endearing. I'm going to lean towards endearing, because he channels a famous movie character of the dearly departed 1980s, and decides to go all Spicoli from Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Oh, well, let me think about this for a minute, dude. I don't know, maybe I'd go back to the West Coast, California. Maybe I'd buy about 30, maybe 40 surfboards, man. Maybe a couple.
I figured.
Yeah, maybe a lot of surfboards, man.
You really think that I might do that, don't you?
Nope.
You think that I'm just a dumb kid from the West Coast? A stupid surfer boy, don't you?
No.
I am from the West Coast, Terry, but I'm a grown-up. Oh, very serious and very intense person, especially when it comes to wrestling, and especially for the world title, and especially when people try and put words into my mouth.
That was so great, because he was goofy, and then he brought it back and was extremely serious at the end, the way that a world champion would be. I love this version of Sting, but I think it goes to show that Terry Funk, no matter where he is in his entire wrestling career, he always makes everything better. No matter if he's on Shotgun Saturday Night, if he's in ECW, or if he's hosting a talk show, maybe with not the best set that he's working with, he manages to get the best out of everybody.
I can't even hear myself talk! You can see it right here, exclusively on TBS at 8:05 Eastern Time.
I've mentioned how hot the crowd was in Johnson City, Tennessee, and as it turns out, there was a TV taping when Crockett was still in business back in the summer of 1988, but right now it's a little bit more of an upbeat time than it was then. Things are starting to trend downwards by the middle of 88 for Crockett, and leading to the sale to Turner, but early 1990 is a little bit different, so the crowd is going insane. And Bud Sawyer is putting his hands over his ears, and the crowd is actually impacting him. And it's kind of like in the NFL at that point, they did not allow the little radios inside the helmet for the coach to talk to the quarterback between plays. So back then, crowds would have a much greater impact with the crowd noise, because the communication was just not the same as it was, because you didn't have it in the helmet. I remember Boomer Esiason having issues at a game in Foxborough, which wasn't known as being a particularly loud stadium, and I think that there were some sort of weird NFL statutes around that time. But anyway, that's not all that important. This is a very important match, and yes, it was on the Clash of Champions, was going to be these same six guys, Arn Anderson, Ric Flair, and Sting, three quarters of the Four Horsemen, facing off against the Great Muta, Dragon Master, and Buzz Sawyer. I wrote in my notes that Buzz Sawyer is certainly the outlier here, and I don't mean in terms of ability or anything else. I just mean, like, he's on the team with two Japanese characters, Muda and Dragon Master, but also the fact that I just kind of make the observation that he's only 30 years old at this point, but he looks at least 40 years old, and he was dead at the age of 32, so only a couple of years after this. It's really sad because I was talking about Jimmy Garvin and guys that I've grown to appreciate while doing this podcast. Buzz Sawyer, of course, very, very high on this list. The crowd, obviously, as I mentioned, very insane for this. Ric Flair has his normal hair still. He does not have the ponytail. He hasn't had a cut in the regular boy's look. So no reason to be upset about anything like that. But this crowd is dying, not only to cheer Sting, who's, you know, the hero now going on a couple of years, but this is a rare opportunity where, oh, we can cheer for Arn Anderson now, and we can freely cheer for Ric Flair. Yes, Flair always had his share of fans, and I guess Arn Anderson too, but it's not like there were Arn Anderson cheering sections. That's why during this period of time, I think, you know, oh, wow, we can actually root for this guy. Signs in the crowd. One of them actually said, Muda is awesome, which, you know, your typical fan sign in 1990 didn't have to be all that complex. In fact, a couple of other signs said, The Great Muda, and then another sign just said, Space Mountain. I don't know if it was some kind of Disney thing that they were trying to promote. Hey, just wait a couple years. They're just going to be doing all their tapings down at Disney World, so you'll be able to go on Space Mountain after watching an hour and a half of matches involving the Gambler and so on and so forth. It's just so unusual to have something like this on TV, but especially considering you're doing the same match a little bit more down the road. But hey, we suffered through Samoan Savage. We suffered through that Freebirds match, and now we are finally here. And Buzz Sawyer and Arn Anderson actually start out this match, and this must be like the battle for who had the best dad bod in all of pro wrestling in 1990, these two guys. And I don't say that to be disrespectful by any means, because Arn Anderson being one of the all-time greats, and I've already spoken chapter and verse of my appreciation for Buzz Sawyer, shoulder block by Arn. And then Buzz, when Arn is running the ropes, leapfrogs, but Arn actually stops, which is one of those little Arn Anderson nuances that he would put into a match. I don't know if this was because Muda was standing on the apron right there and could have just laid a kick to the back of his head, you know, the Bret Hart Memorial transition move.
He's not fucking dead.
Well, even if he's not, I still think it was a smart move to not run the ropes and run that risk of having Muda kick him in the back of the head. We get the tag to Sting. And the crowd just goes, icky baluki, as a Patriots broadcaster once said. He slingshots into the ring with his shoulder block. All six men end up in the ring, and it is Sting, Flair, and Arn who end up alone in the ring as the heels take a powder out on the floor. I kind of wanted to see how much further Jim Ross could go with that rhyming scheme that he was going with, the Pier 6 Brawl, Walking Tall at Freedom Hall. Let me see if I can go a little bit further with it. Pier 6 Brawl, well, I'll just call that the title. Walking Tall at Freedom Hall, one and all, crowd in state of enthrall. Ole gets the ball, Ole makes the call. Sting's gonna fall, it's gonna cast a pall. He hits the wall, he has to crawl. But who gets the ball? Why, it's Lex from the mall. All right, I know that that's still a few years off, but work with me on that. I mean, Lex Luger, one of his biggest WCW moments was in a shopping mall. In the comments, they scrawl, that's from 95, y'all. Okay, so that's how I'm going to cover it. That it's not exactly in Flanders Fields, but it will have to do. I mean, after all, this is pro wrestling we're talking about here. It's always weird, in my opinion, when you see Ric Flair in a tag match working the apron. It just feels so out of context. Like when Jerry sees George's dad on Seinfeld in Manhattan, he says, it's so weird seeing him here. It's so out of context. That's Ric Flair in a tag match. He is Frank Costanza in Manhattan. It's just a little bit off. Sting and Buzz Sawyer have a face-off in the ring, not actually wrestling, but having a kind of yell-off. Not that the crowd needs any help with the noise, as Jim Cornette says that somebody's going to get brain damage like Pete Townsend just based on the noise that happened. I don't know, apparently something must have happened with Pete Townsend. I looked up to see if I could find anything, but you know, Pete Townsend stories during the, oh, he lost his hearing and this and that. I mean, you really can't differentiate one from the other. Sting with a press slam of Buzz Sawyer, and then Muta runs in and he gets pressed up and he's held up there for quite a while. And Buzz and Dragon Master are outside the ring, so he just tosses the Great Muta onto both of them. The kids in the crowd, you notice particularly, are going insane for this. And this goes into my theory about Sting being not a person who was a draw in the traditional sense, but what I call a long-term draw, where he gets a kid who, oh, I like Sting, and they become attached to the product in that way. Like a lot of people my age, you know, had Sting as their favorite wrestler growing up. And now they're buying tickets to go to wrestling events, but obviously Sting ain't wrestling anymore. Thank you very much, Seth Rollins, Mr. Safe Worker that you are. Jim Ross points out that Lex Luger has an issue with all of this going on with the Sting-Flair match coming up at WrestleWar. But I should point out to Luger, if you really wanted the, you know, that title shot, you should have won the damn tournament at Starrcade. I mean, after all, he did beat Sting in it, but Sting ended up winning the tournament, which, I mean, say what you will about the way they did the Iron Man tournament at Starrcade 89, but they booked it in a pretty good way where they put Sting over, but they also made sure that Luger would have an issue as well. Flair obviously didn't mean to win, and unfortunately, the Great Muta was nothing but collateral damage. But you got the U.S. champ having also a claim to being number one contender, and Luger actually says that he's going to be in the match one way or another, which, of course, would come to fruition, and you could maybe float a conspiracy theory on that. Sting starts fighting all three guys in the opposite corner, and it's also interesting, I mentioned how Flair being on the apron is just weird. He hasn't gotten his hands dirty in this match yet, as the Great Muta tags into the ring. And the way he runs the ropes during this time period, it's not 100% technically sound. It's not, if you were in a wrestling school, and I'm not anybody who's qualified to teach this, but he does not run the ropes in a very traditional way, but it looks kind of, I don't know, I want to say it looks realer, but there's a certain coolness to the way he does it. It just kind of snaps. I don't know really what else to say about it. But he gets monkey flipped and ends up in the wrong corner, and Flair now actually gets in a shot, an elbow to the back of the head of Muta from the apron. He gets into the ring formally and get a chop, a right hand and a chop, and then a backdrop, but then Muta answers by going to the eyes. Dragon Master is in, but then Flair ends up working him over. Arn Anderson tags in. He's got Dragon Master on the other side, who reverses an Irish whip. Then he puts his head down, a cardinal mistake for a ring veteran. And yes, that is the fourth time that has happened on this edition of the Power. If you feel like I'm repeating that phrase over and over again, yes, it's happened a lot on this show. An elbow by Arn, but then Dragon Master tags out to Buzz, and once again we get the dad bod bowl back on as Buzz gains some measure of control, but he misses on, certainly not going to call it an SD Jones Memorial Charge because he's above that level, but he eats the ring post, and you know what that means. Arn Anderson's going to go right to work on that left arm that hit the post, kind of running it into the guardrail, as there are some very interesting looking people down in the front row in Johnson City, which Jim Cornette obviously is going to call attention to.
I'll tell you what, these two guys, look at Morticia Adams and her family in the front row. They're going to a funeral after the show.
Wednesday's grown up.
She sure has. I wonder if that was Pugsley. Anyway,
I was wondering if the Addams Family movie was out around this time, but no, that was actually 1991, so still a year plus away. As Buzz Sawyer and Sting are in now, and Buzz starts biting Sting like the Piranha character from Nintendo's pro wrestling game. I would only choose the Piranha if I was in a real sour mood. Like, if I was really angry, I would actually choose him. But Sting battles back. He tags out to Ric Flair, and we get a chop exchange in the corner between Rick and Buzz Sawyer. It was kind of an interesting matchup where Flair is probably the slightly bigger guy, I would say. Tag to Dragon Master, a much less interesting matchup. The Flair knee drop tags out to Arn, and then he starts working the left leg in very precise fashion. Locks in a toe hold, and now they're cutting off the ring. Tag into Sting, who goes for the Scorpion Deathlock, but that is broken up almost immediately. Now we get Muda and Flair in there, and Muda puts his head down. A cardinal mistake for a ring veteran. That is number 5 on this show. Flair hits an elbow. And I know it's weird with Ric Flair in a tag match and all, but he is so fun to watch being the fired up babyface in this spot because it's not something we got to see on a regular basis. It's so much fun. It's what I want from my wrestling. But part of that, I guess, owes to the fact that it was unusual. I mean, if he was like that all the time, I mean, by the end of his career, he kind of turns into that. Anyway, get a back suplex and a figure four, and that is broken up because we're not going to disqualify anybody for anything like this. But now Flair ends up in peril. Corner whip, you can probably imagine what happens. Flair does the flip in the corner, but does the version where instead of running down the ring apron, he tumbles out to the floor where he gets worked over a little bit more. He gets some help from Arn Anderson and eventually goes to the eyes, but still ends up in trouble. He gets sent into the ring post, his right arm, and now back inside. Buzz Sawyer hits a power slam off an Irish whip. So in thinking about the Ted DiBiase scale, I recall, because I took my notes for this back in July on an airplane, and I thought to myself, this is when I thought about renaming it the Buzz Sawyer scale, because how good was this power slam? I'm giving it 11 Teds out of 10, because he got entirely underneath Flair on it. It wasn't like a traditional, it was almost like a pitcher in baseball throwing straight over the top and throwing a 12-6 curveball. It was just beautiful. I mean, hey, look at me. I'm giving the team from Japan and Buzz Sawyer extra credit here. I'm giving him the plus one over the 10 out of 10 for whatever that's worth. Muda gets in. He cuts off the ring. A vertical suplex is actually countered into an inside cradle by Flair. That only gets a 2 count. But the handspring elbow by Muda, I was going to say I give it 11 Chinas out of 10, but I remembered that my China scale is actually inverted. So that would actually be -1 Chinas out of 10, meaning it is a proper handspring elbow that he is performing. Dragon Master is in, and now Flair with the cross corner. He does the flip over again, but this time he does run down the ring apron, but he runs right into the heel corner, has an elbow for Buzz Sawyer, and he goes right up to the top rope, hits a forearm to the top of the head of the Dragon Master. So now Flair trying to make the tag, and we get the hot tag to Sting, and you can imagine the crowd's reaction on that. Now, clearly, with the main event for The Clash coming up, you have to do a screwy finish here, or else that upcoming match is not going to mean a damn thing if you just beat them cleanly here. Sting gets the green mist. So he said the mist. I know people like to differentiate between the colors. Green is the lowest one, which you say, well, why doesn't he just use the red one or a higher power one? Well, he has to bring that out at select times, Muda does. I mean, you can't just use the most expensive thing all the time. The green thing also might be easy to get through customs. I don't know. I don't know. I'm not an Asian mist expert, okay? And I don't employ one for this podcast because I just don't talk about it enough. But they lay out Sting good as they took care of Arn and Ric Flair at the same time. Sawyer hits the Superfly Splash on him after the match, after the DQ. Excuse me, not the Superfly Splash.
Flying Belly Whopper.
Yeah, that's fine. I'll call it a Flying Belly Whopper. I mean, I was making fun of his dad bod earlier. But you got this six-man coming up at the Clash, so the finish makes sense. But holy God, was this crowd invested. It makes it just a little bit more fun to watch. It reminds me, to a lesser extent, I was talking about the emotion that came out when watching the Iron Sheik and Hogan from MSG 84 on the last show. Here, it's kind of the same thing, but kind of from a what could have been with Sting and how nuts the crowd is going for him, and also how nuts they're going for Ric Flair and Arn Anderson as babyface horsemen, if maybe that could have lasted a little bit longer. But hey, maybe it only feels special because it lasted for such a short period of time.
This week's Wrestler of the Week, you need no appointment to see this doctor.
This week's Wrestler of the Week, and I know for a fact he's the baddest man on God's green earth, Dr. Death, Steve Williams. He's going up against Lex Luger February 25th. He may not be the brightest guy, but he is the baddest guy, the Wrestler of the Week.
Wow, I can't believe Dr. Death Steve Williams won Wrestler of the Week on a show hosted by Jim Ross. I really cannot believe that at all. And what's the thing on this show calling all the baby faces stupid? I know I alluded to the thing with Sting and saying, well, maybe people thought that about him with the Horsemen and they're projecting it backwards from stuff that happened later. But Italian Stallion and Dr. Death, by the way, both guys played stunt doubles for Lyle Alzado on Learning the Ropes. I feel like I should go back and do another Learning the Ropes episode in sort of a review. But then again, sometimes I look at it and I say, people like the WWF shows more than the others, so who knows? That's what I kind of look at.
Sunday on the main event.
Interrupt me while I'm doing
my
thing.
I'm sorry, but there's no main event Sunday.
No main event?
We're preempted this Sunday night.
Do you know what we had planned for that show?
Yep.
Do you know how great that show was? That was going to be the greatest main event of all time, and it's not going to be on?
Call Uncle Ted.
Write letters. Write your congressman. Write your senator. Write your governor. Do something. Make some telephone calls. Send some telegrams out. Do something to stop this awful carnage. There's going to be no main event on Sunday.
But
you can see NWA Wrestling on Saturday on World Championship Wrestling. That's 6:05.
All right.
But I'm just upset.
Well, let me
there's
calm
no
down.
Main event.
Calm down. The Power Hour next Friday night.
Yeah. I know wrestling would get preempted a lot on TBS for Braves baseball or NBA basketball or what have you. But in this case, there's actually kind of a good excuse because the main event would have been going up against the Super Bowl, I think, or the Super Bowl pregame show, which is probably more exciting than that Super Bowl, because like I said, the final score was 55-10, and it was one of the worst Super Bowls ever, and one that I did not even watch all the way to the end, and I watch every freaking Super Bowl all the way to the end. So, while there's no main event, this was the NWA Power Hour airing on the Friday night of that weekend, so that's a wrap for NWA Power Hour for January 26, 1990. In other podcasts this week, I should mention first that WorldCast did not do World Class Championship Wrestling this week, instead taking a detour in doing Super Clash 4 from the AWA, which is apparently on the WWE Network, and in listening to that, it really made me actually want to watch Super Clash 4. I don't know what that says about me, because it's the AWA in 1990, and I damn near went insane when I did a show on that earlier this year. But on the Our Vantage Point podcast with Joe Morata and Michael Quinn, they finish up their Royal Ranking series on finishers, the greatest finisher of all time. I have a feeling it might be RKO, Stone Cold Stunner, some variation of that thing. And on the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing, we had the big announcement, as Mike Crockett was putting out there. And I wondered, what could that possibly be, given that Brian Malonis, Brawler Malonis, has not been there honoring his Ring of Honor commitments, no pun intended. They announced that Brian Fury would now be a regular co-host of the pod for when Brian Malonis can't be there for whatever. So I've had fun coming up with names for the show. The best one that I came up with was when it's Crockett and Fury. It could be The Mound and the Fury. But I'm willing to accept other submissions for that one. Steve Bennett of the Sportscasters, I believe, off this week, because he was in New Orleans this past weekend. He texted me a picture. Him and Drew Brees on the field at the Superdome, which is pretty damn cool. I myself have my own picture with Zdeno Chara from 2007. I always link Chara and Brees because they joined their respective teams in 2006 when they were definitely at a low point. But my picture with Chara features me wearing a Red Sox hat, and boy, there's a lot of pictures of me in past years just wearing the stuff from teams like that. Yeah, do you cheer for that team? Or like me wearing a Nationals hat, me wearing a Phillies hat, me wearing a Pittsburgh Penguins jersey. It goes on and on. I can make that like a whole thing. But do check out those other podcasts that I mentioned a little bit earlier. Now, Vinny Vegas Corner went 1-2 last week. 8-7 on the year. Not giving you the full music for Vinny Vegas Corner. Sorry, Brandon from New Jersey, but I'll just do the three picks really quickly and tell you, first of all, that I am not touching that Washington versus Miami game this weekend. Yes, the two winless teams are playing each other, and Miami is still a 3.5-point home underdog to a team that fired their head coach earlier in the week. It's just so insane. And I sure as hell like touching a Patriots-Giants game because they scare the hell out of me even to this day. I'm still a little bit scarred. So I'm going to go Seattle giving 1 point in Cleveland, Kansas City giving 5 points at home against Houston. I can't imagine that they'll be as bad as they looked last week. And Denver giving 2.5 at home against Tennessee. Now, while you may not have gotten the familiar music for Vinny Vegas Corner, you do now in the background hear the other familiar music from a closing segment on Greetings from Allentown. Yes, it is time for another edition of YouTube Comment Theater. Since there are about a dozen comments on this video, and they're actually worth going through, and it shouldn't take too long. I mean, the NWA 1990, everybody kind of loves that. We'll start out with GoldenEye X, who says, at 1 minute 54 seconds of the video, Michael Myers is coming, better watch out. Yeah, apparently the Samoan Savage came out to some music from Halloween that I just didn't pick up on because the sound doesn't come through all that great, and I guess I just wasn't paying attention and not looking out for it. Frank Jones says, back when wrestling was great, can't watch it much now. I mean, give me a break with that. I mean, if you can't find something to like that's for wrestling that's on TV this week between AEW, NXT, SmackDown, Raw, or NWA Power on YouTube earlier in the week, which that's the one I'm excited to get a chance to watch, like that, because I've nothing but glowing reviews from what I've heard. Mufo Zombie says, Sawyer rules! I don't know if that's in relation to O'Doyle rules, but yes, of course, I have a great appreciation for Buzz Sawyer as well. GoldenEye X also said, I love JR, but he's much better in WWF than NWA /WCW. Well, you know, I guess different strokes for different folks. I think he was maybe a little too over the top in the Attitude Era, and also he had a lot more to work with, I think, in my opinion. Mark Bowman says, always thought that was so cool when the Samoan SWAT team would come down the aisle to the theme from the classic horror movie Halloween. Yeah, I just never noticed that. I'm sorry, but then again, I'm not much of a horror movie guy. Christian Hollister says, exchanging talent. Absolutely great. And this is the go-home show before the clash where Flair turned on Sting, and the rest, they say, is history. Well, there would be one more week of shows, and then the clash was, I believe, on the following Tuesday after that. Philip Martin says, Cornette killed it with the Crockett joke. And yeah, he came out of the gate really hot, but he was still funny throughout this show. But they set it up perfectly to rip on David Crockett's 1+ year after he had last been an announcer on the show. Biff Roberts says, man, that crowd was electric. They're like, yeah, you're telling me. Justin Credible, 214, says, was this when Sting was a horseman? Well, dude, just watch the freaking video and you could probably figure it out. And then finally, Sick Fix says, thanks for putting this up, Bo. Nostalgia like this is more precious than gold. And yes, it is Mr. Bo James who posted this on his YouTube channel, and I certainly appreciate that. He's a regular guest on Between the Sheets. I think he's actually on this week's show that they did from 1987. I listened to that just the other day. That'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. A couple of weeks ago, JT Rosero of the Place to Be podcast reached out to me and said that somebody had requested a specific show that they do on the Place to Be podcast. Well, they have their timeline that they're going through, and they were requesting a specific random episode of WWF television from 1993. So, I don't remember who it was, but sure, I figure why not? I'll take a look at it, and maybe I'll go ahead and do it. Well, next week will be the week, and it's the May 8th, 1993 edition of WWF Mania. Excuse me, it's actually May 9th, 1993. And there is a lot on this particular program. And one thing that I had not considered from shows in the mid-90s is on those C shows, you would get King of the Ring qualifiers airing from Raw or Superstars or wherever they had originally been done. And on this show, a lot of named guys, in fact, not much in the way of squash matches other than Mr. Hughes, who's in action from an episode of Wrestling Challenge. We get Kamala taking on Bam Bam Bigelow in a Mania exclusive, and it's fitting that it's a Mania exclusive since that was supposed to be on WrestleMania 9 and it got bumped for time or whatever. But we also have, as the aforementioned King of the Ring qualifiers, Lex Luger taking on Bob Backlund. What a strange match that is. Mr. Perfect taking on Doink, and this is good Doink, this is Matt Bourne, so it's kind of a throwback to the good old Portland days. And also a random Shawn Michaels and Hacksaw Jim Duggan match that is joined in progress at some point. So a lot of King of the Ring 93 stuff involved with that show, so I look forward to doing that. As I get close to wrapping up for this week, I do have one favor to ask of you, and hopefully I do not get impeached or anybody opens an inquiry for me asking for something in return for me providing a podcast every week for the last 2.5 years, is please leave a review on iTunes/Apple Podcasts. A 5-star review is definitely preferred because it provides what is known as social proof that you are listening to and enjoying this particular podcast. It would go a long way towards finding your way into my heart. I don't know where I'm going with that, but I thank you in advance for that. And obviously, I thank you so much for listening. And do tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
Why in the world would you want to see where David Crockett was born? Took you long enough to get him off the announcing staff around here.